It was one of the ravens, the familiars of Ontez, the vulture lady. With one swift, terrible motion, the monster swung out a claw-tipped hand and sliced off a man's head. Chapter 16. Chaos erupted below as people trampled one another to get out of the way. The bird creature flapped its arms and struck a woman, knocking her to the ground. "Why would Ontez send one of her ravens? She stays in Canterbury," I said, horrified.
"Attacks don't only happen at night, my ducky. Old Relam's fighting a war, and he means to win it."
"Why don't the sorcerers do something?" He glared at me.
"Because the familiars don't attack the ward, dear heart, and that's all the Order cares about," he grunted as he looked out the window. "This is the fourth time in 2 months. I should move. It's not fair to the area."
"Why should you move?"
"The magic," he said, as though it were obvious. "The ancients and their familiars are drawn to the scent of it, like ants to a sticky bun."
London was filled with sorcerers. Was the city under constant attack because of us?
"Come," Hargrove said. "I'll show you a way out."
"If our power called these creatures, we should be the ones to put a stop to it." I grabbed his coat sleeve as he brushed past me.
"I don't have to do anything, if it's between them or me. I choose me."
He yanked himself from my grip. I looked back out the window. The familiar sliced its way through a man's chest, leaving him to bleed out on the ground. The streets turned a roiling crimson as the thing threw back its head and screamed in triumph, arm wings bristling. My hands felt hot. When I pulled open the front door, Hargrove slammed it shut.
"You'll get yourself killed," he snapped.
"Help me. I know I can't fight it on my own." I grabbed porridge from its sheath.
"You want to throw a little wind and rain at it? It'll take more than weather play, you stupid thing."
"Help me," I pointed at the door. "Or I'll go down there and die in the attempt, and you'll have to live with the guilt of failing my father."
"I think you're overestimating how much I liked him," Hargrove muttered. "But all right. Wait."
He ran to the back of the room and thrust the curtain aside, dispersing the children while he dragged out a wooden chest. He banged on the lid twice, and it swung open. One by one, the children stepped into the chest and disappeared, making little noises of excitement or terror as they did so. Once the last child had vanished, Hargrove closed the lid, tapped upon it 3 times, and reopened it. The trunk now contained a collection of odds and ends, bits of string and candles and toys, tarnished copper bells and golden rings in the shape of dragons, lace handkerchiefs and glass vials of thick, odd-coloured liquid. An aroma of moths and rose petals wafted out.
"Where did the children go?"
Storage. This is what we need."
He selected something, shut the box, and went to the window, covering it with what appeared to be a large and durable spiderweb.
"What are you doing?"
"I'll need extra power for this. Use your stave."
He put his hands to the web and said,
"Weave it with your malice, woven with your gall. Grow to catch a spider, strength to see it fall."
My nose crinkled in distaste.
"Well, it works for me. Activate toast or marmalade or whatever that stave's name is and use it as best you can. Only remember to envision something big enough to catch that creature."
I put porridge to the web, closed my eyes and imagined a great net strong enough to hold a bird. Nothing happened.
"I thought you said I was a magician."
"Stop whining and think of exactly what you want to do."
Intentions. I had to be specific in my intentions. The screams below spurred me on. I envisioned the web catching that raven, saw the bird squawk and collapse as I snared it. First, I had to weave the web, make it grow. I spun my stave in a gradual spiral, beginning at the center and spreading outward. I imagined it growing larger, big enough to catch the bastard. Catch it! Catch it! Catch!
It worked! Hargrove yelled.
I opened my eyes and stared out the window. The familiar lay pinned to the earth in the center of the street, trapped beneath an enormous spiderweb. I opened the front door against Hargrove's protests, pulling my cloak on and my hood around my face. The creature began to rip free. Running down the steps, I sliced my stave through the air 3 times, using my anger as fuel. The wind rushed out of the east and pounded the thing. When the familiar raised its winged arms to shield itself, the gale ushered it into the sky. I slipped back into an alleyway and hugged the wall, watching the familiar struggle in the wind. Out of nowhere, a great red and purple and orange cloak appeared, flapping in the breeze. The garment swept upward and wrapped itself around the raven. It looked as if the two were wrestling. With a wave of my hand, I stopped the wind. The raven plummeted to earth. When it landed, the coat rose up and flew away quickly, as if attempting to sneak off. The familiar lay still. Slowly, people began to approach. I kept my head down and inched forward in the crowd, stopping above the collapsed pile of rags and feathers to stare at the now dead thing. I glimpsed the less than human face beneath the cowl. Its teeth were pointed and black, skin whiter than chalk, except where bits of crimson blood and gore had splashed onto its chin. Black feathers covered the top of the monster's head, so that I could not see the eyes, and a once human nose had sharpened into a pointed beak. Brackish liquid oozed from a stab wound in the raven's sunken chest. Someone grabbed me by the shoulder and, placing a hand over my mouth, spun me into a whirlwind. A moment later, hands released me. I stumbled around to face my attacker, Hargrove, who smiled and nodded behind me.
"Don't step back. It's quite a fall."
He grabbed me when I didn't listen and almost tumbled into space. We stood atop a roof. Below us, the crowd's confusion was a persistent murmur. Balanced on the roof's slope, Hargrove cleaned blood off a silver blade.
Another great defect of the sorcerers is they don't get creative with their weaponry. Magic is fine, but a knife works marvelously well. Ravens tend to die best with a blade of silver. I wrote all about it in my journal. The life and times of a really fantastic magician. His thoughts and theories, Volume 7.
He studied his reflection in the blade's surface and licked his thumb, rubbing it over a patch of black blood on his forehead. How did you fly without wind? How on earth did you disappear? How did you get us up here? My voice was high and breathless. It was impossible. It was brilliant.
Those, he said, slipping the knife into the folds of his coat, are the sorts of questions you can't ask.
You don't have to teach me how to do what you do. Just teach me
how I do what I do, but not how to do what I do. What if what I do has to do with my knowledge of what to do, and doing requires only the knowledge of doing? What would you do then?
I blinked. I believe you hurt my brain.
It's a good brain, all things considered. Listen, my adorable bonfire, I cannot teach you much. Our safety requires it. But I suppose a little magic never did a body a great deal of harm. unless it was the magical art of rearranging bones, or turning flesh inside out, or... Never mind. Really, I'd forgotten how much I missed being collegial with my own kind. A magician without an apprentice is like a dog without a bark.
Will you teach me how to fight them?
I waved my hand over the familiar's corpse, far below.
How to kill them?
Bloodthirsty, are we? You don't want to go and get yourself slaughtered before your big commendation.
I can't let these people suffer. If the Order won't do anything, I will.
Hargrove sighed. Very well. Next lesson, we'll discuss battle techniques.
I may not be able to come often.
Whatever time you can spare.
He looked at me with something like sadness.
You did well today. You used a bit of magician trickery yourself, you know, even with the stave. I'm sure some of that will bleed into our lessons. Now, speaking of blood, I must seek out a bath. He wrapped the cloak around us and, instantly, we stood in the alleyway again.
Thank you. I'm glad to know my father had such a good friend.
No, don't think that. His expression darkened. If there's one thing your father was unlucky in, it was his friends.
Before I could ask what he meant, he folded himself tight within his cloak and vanished. The familiar approached me from across the room. She licked her dry lips with a thick black tongue and hummed deep in her throat. This was the rider I had met, the one with the eyes sewn shut with coarse black thread.
"Little Lady Sorcerer," she hissed.
Her thin, white blonde hair lay stringy against her face, down her back. She was even more hideous than I remembered. I sank down onto the sofa, trying to keep my wits about me. This was a dream. We were seated in the mist-shrouded library. I looked across the room to my sleeping body collapsed over my desk. This would teach me to study when I was so tired. Would these visitations happen every time I went to sleep? I tried not to panic. If Relem could kill me in a dream, I felt certain he would have done so already. These last 3 nights, he'd followed me about the room wherever I went. He'd watched me struggle to wake up, an amused smile on his face. But he had never touched me. Perhaps he couldn't. And there he was. Relem appeared beside the rider, a pleased expression on his skinned face.
"Do you like her?"
he said to me. The girl knelt at his feet as if she'd twine about his legs like a pet cat. "No," I replied. Relem laughed at my sullen response. He chucked the familiar under her chin. With a wave of his hand, she vanished.
"No fear this time. You did well."
"Did well? What does that mean? How are you doing this? What do you want from me?" He didn't respond, only came to offer me his hand. I rose without it and backed toward the fire. Wherever I went in the room, he moved after me at a leisurely gait. He seemed to take enormous pleasure in my confusion. I tried a different tack. "Are the ancients attacking London because of the scent of magic?" There, that finally stopped him. "You're attacking us because so many magic users live inside the ward, aren't you?" Relem sneered.
"Ask your great men what sins they've committed."
since. Now he regarded me with real interest.
Who told you this?
I wouldn't give Hargrove away. I want to wake up now. Relam strode toward me. Before I could dodge him, he grabbed me by the wrist. His touch was slippery and cold. Bloody. I screamed and struggled. His grip tightened. He was squeezing hard enough to break my...
Howl?
Magnus shook me awake. I swung about blindly, sending paper flying all across the desk.
Sorry, I didn't realize you were so determined to sleep.
I must have nodded off, I muttered, rubbing my eyes. Magnus grabbed my wrist.
Did you cut yourself?
Looking down, I discovered fingerprints shining wet with blood. I pulled away and wiped off the marks with my handkerchief. I scratched myself when I was out in the garden. It must have bled more than I thought, I said lamely. What would have happened had Magnus not woken me? Perhaps he would have discovered my mangled corpse at this desk. Trying to appear preoccupied, I grasped my pen and looked over a piece of paper. Magnus watched me with his back against the hearth. After a minute, I gave in.
Yes, I was just wondering, he said, arms crossed over his chest. Why you were outside the ward today?
I dropped the pen. I wasn't.
You were, and you clobbered that raven with a blast of wind. I planned to join in the fray myself, but it was over before I could do anything. Why were you there?
I stood and turned away from him. I didn't see you follow me.
You spoke to me.
I didn't. I looked back at him, confused. When?
He hunched himself and shouldered past. Excuse me, miss, he said in a gruff, familiar tone.
You were the fellow who bumped into me. How did you know where I was going?
I saw you sneaking down to the kitchen for food, so I followed. Why did you go?
I wanted to bring something to that horrible magician Hargrove's children. Please, don't tell Master Agrippa. I realized I'd given Magnus power over me. Damn.
How did you have such control over the wind? You couldn't even lift a feather during lessons this morning.
Sometimes when you have to do something, you find you can. Would he accept that and say no more? Magnus nodded.
I suppose that makes sense. You did well, actually, battling that thing. Hideous beasts, aren't they?
Yes. Were you aware that familiars sometimes attack the unwarded area during the day? I felt ill, recalling the carnage I'd witnessed. He looked uncomfortable.
No. The Order likes to keep secrets from us, don't you think?
He spun a globe that sat atop the desk, skimming his fingers across the Pacific Ocean. We should do something about it.
We will, once we're commended. We can change things.
He leaned against the desk, the image of confidence. You believe that, don't you?
I never have any trouble believing in myself, he smiled, but there was no cockiness in his expression. And I was right to believe in you. In time, you'll be a great sorcerer.
Do you think?
Yes,
he said it without doubt or hesitation. Why? I asked, without thinking.
Why what?
Why are you so kind to me? I lowered my eyes. Somehow I felt very exposed.
Because I'm wonderful? Hadn't you noticed?
No, I said. Why have you never doubted my place as a sorcerer? His smile faded a bit.
Because I've seen how a woman is treated when she dares to step outside her domain.
He went to stand before the fire. There was pain in his eyes, something I'd never seen before.
After Father died, My uncle thought I needed to be raised by men. I was a Magnus, after all. We're warriors, have been since before Rome fell. He wanted to raise me himself, but Mother fought to keep me. She endured many great men bullying her, telling her what a little fool she was, that I'd grow up weak, weak, like a woman. He winced. Mother never yielded. Have I turned out so very bad? He looked up as I came beside him. No, I smiled. So, when I see a lady go up against a group of men who claim to know better than she does, I find I want her to succeed. You will succeed, Hal. My cheeks grew hot. I'll have a better chance of success once I get my blasted lessons down. There's still so much I don't know. I moved to the desk to straighten my papers. Reading only takes me so far. Magnus came up beside me. I'm the very soul of experience. Let me tutor you. In what? Whatever you wish. He raised an eyebrow. Name anything. I thought for a moment. How did you bespell me into not recognizing you on the street? Who said it was magic? He laughed and clapped his hands. That's what an actor does, my dear Hal. He shows you what you want to see. I'll remember that. Another question, my intrepid lady. I recalled Hargrove sheathing his silver blade. Why don't sorcerers employ more human weapons? Maybe it would be useful against some familiars, if not the ancients themselves. Well, we do train in sabers and pistols, Magnus said. Lord, didn't I know it? The first time I fired a gun, I'd been thrown to the ground. But do we use them much in battle? Magnus gave a surprised laugh. I suppose that's a topic to discuss with the Imperator. Anyway, we use some blades more than others. His eyes lit up. How's this for helpful? I'll instruct you in another class of weaponry, one you haven't yet learned. You should handle it a bit better than the pistols. Magnus was the finest warrior in our house, without question. Anything he had to teach would be massively helpful. Thank you. Yes. They're called warded blades. Master Agrippa wanted to wait until you'd a few more maneuvers in hand, but I see no reason to hold off. You take the ward you draw up around yourself, slide it down your arm to your stave, and fashion it with your thoughts into a weapon. Like this. He took his stave and activated it with the name Excalibur. What? He said, when I laughed. I loved the Arthur legend when I was 14. That was right before I noticed how exciting girls were. Good thing I didn't get my stave later, or I might have named it Louisa, or Marianne, or Emily. Perhaps we should start before you name every girl in London, I said. He showed me how to put the ward up about myself, how to imagine that protective bubble shrinking on my body and gathering in my arm, and then how to slide it off my arm and onto my stave. With enough practice, you'll be able to create the blade with a simple thought. Now you see it, faint yellow and pointed. This will cut better than a human sword. Indeed, the outline was scarcely visible, but when I put my thumb to the blade, it sliced me. Magnus showed me how to hold the stave, my index and middle fingers on top for balance. Now, your movement stays central. Always keep the torso firm, he said, placing a hand on my stomach. As the weapon is light, you'll want more control. Movement comes from your shoulder, not your elbow. With Magnus lined up behind me, I created a few elegant sweeps. After that, he taught me some simple parries. We bumped into chairs and knocked over the desk globe.
You won't have many great battles with these, I laughed, lunging at him. He easily blocked me.
No, but this is tremendous fun if you want to see the fear in your enemy's eyes.
With that, he knocked porridge from my hand and grabbed me about the waist.
Voila! I've captured you.
His arm stayed firm about me.
Perhaps I won't allow you to escape, he said,
his cheek against mine.
Oh?
My pulse quickened as he pulled back just enough to meet my gaze. Magnus stroked the side of my face, his fingertips trailing warmth.
Has anyone ever mentioned that you have a little freckle at the corner of your eye?
No. I knew I should look away, but I couldn't. This wasn't Magnus with his normal, silly flirtations.
I suppose it's unattractive.
Hardly. It draws attention to your eyes, which are brilliant. He leaned in. I think you have the loveliest eyes I've ever seen, come to think of it. They're so dark, they're almost black, which gives you a very fierce expression in battle. But if I draw closer, and he did, gently, I see warm brown. When your gaze is soft, there are flecks of gold. Nothing about you is ever quite how it appears.
I look tired. I know I do, I murmured.
His arm tightened around me.
That's nothing a good night's sleep won't cure.
He cupped my cheek in his hand for one brief moment.
You've a beautiful face, Howl, he whispered.
He stroked my chin with this thumb. I closed my eyes.
What about Rook?
Thank you. That is, for teaching me, I said, pulling away from him. I gathered porridge, fumbling a bit.
You did well for a first-timer. You'll play the game in the end, though not as well as I.
He bowed. The softness of his look and voice disappeared. But we both knew what had happened. I felt as if the portraits, the books, even the fire, bore witness.
You can win the games. And I'll win the battles, I said, exiting at a brisk pace.
I took the stairs at a run. Back in my room, I sat by the window, my breath fogging the glass. I closed my eyes. Magnus thought I was beautiful. The way he'd looked at me and touched me. What would have happened if I hadn't pulled away?
He's a flirt.
I knew that, and I'd never taken his teasing seriously before. But this had felt like more. Did I want more? What was I talking about after what had nearly happened with Rook in the kitchen? What was I doing, entertaining these ridiculous ideas of Magnus? But Rook was still being distant with me. His disappointment in my refusal to run away was evident, no matter what he said. His disappointment in me was evident. What was I doing considering any of this? Rook was my friend, Magnus my ally. That was all they were. All they could be. There was commendation, and if I got that far, there would be war afterward. Life was complicated enough. I resolved to stop thinking about the pair of them immediately. It took an hour of tracing patterns on the fogged window before I finally did.
Chapter 17 Hargrove placed the teapot on the table and rolled up his sleeves.
Your training begins.
Turn this into a mouse and be quick about it. I want it back into its regular form in time for tea. This was far more than I'd expected from my first proper lesson. It was the following day, Sunday, where all that was required of Agrippa's incumbents was to attend church. I had used my freedom to rush right back to Hargrove's. "Do I just poke at it?" I murmured, gesturing with my stave. Hargrove's five children circled us, seated on the floor with their faces cupped in their hands. With an impatient huff, Hargrove knocked four times on the lid of his wooden chest. It sprang open in an explosion of paper and parchment. He burrowed his way through scrolls and letters and scraps of notepaper until, with a cry of triumph, he held up a leather-bound book. Dusting it, he threw it onto the table and riffled through the pages until he alighted on the desired one. "Here," he said. I squinted and stared at the watery, handwritten text. "I can't read it. Must I do everything myself? It clearly says, whisker from a steaming spout, handle to a tail, china cracks to beating heart, fur and tooth and nail." I pointed my stave at the teapot and repeated the words. Hargrove wailed in exasperation. "Well, what am I supposed to do? No two magicians are the same. We're like delicate snowflakes or ears." That line was originally written in Latin, something Muris Fumo, something. Well, I knew a magician once, Peg Bottleshanks, who used some Latin and some English and some musical notes from her nose whistle. You see? Total madness. Master Agrippa says a system is needed. Hargrove blew a rude noise that thrilled the children. "We don't bother with rules." "But how will I know what's correct? Far as you're concerned, the word correct no longer exists. For instance, what say I walk on the ceiling?" "Gravity doesn't work that way," I snapped. Hargrove billowed his multicoloured cloak about him, mumbled, "Flippity-bop, to the top, allons-y, charge!" And to my surprise, fell upward. Upside down, he danced a jig along the rafters, shaking free dust and a few cobwebs. The children applauded and cried with joy. After a moment, he returned in triumph. "You were saying, young upstart?" "How do I do that?" "I don't know if you can. Play around with it. See what you find." "I don't like this," I said, shaking my head. "The sorcerers have traditions." "You like traditions?" I moved around the table to the wooden chest and rummaged through piles of crumpled rubbish. I winced at the mess. "I don't enjoy this much disorder." "You're more of a sorcerer than I thought," he mused, "which is as it should be, if we want you to pass. What say we focus on controlling your gifts? You made progress last time, when you lifted that chair." "Leave a lesson unfinished? Never." "I'll turn that teapot into a mouse, to show I can." With that, I waved my hands and said the words exactly as Hargrove had spoken them to me. Nothing happened. I repeated the words while pointing porridge. Still, nothing. It went on like this for several minutes. Hargrove uncorked a bottle of gin with his teeth and sat, gulping it down. He drank too much. I attempted the entire thing in French. "And you've a fine accent, my cherub. I could listen to you say souris all day long." And when that didn't work, I said a few unladylike words and sat down to stare at the little teapot. It was white and chipped at the spout, with tiny roses painted on it. I'd no idea what to do.
I took porridge in hand again, and I could feel it warm in my grasp, almost like a living thing. It was impatient. I could picture myself drawing forth a mouse from the chiseled confines of a teapot. And in drawing forth, I imagined the sorcerer maneuver that called water from the earth to be used in cases of dire thirst. I spun my stave clockwise and counterclockwise and swept it through the air in an arc. The teapot moved slightly. Hargrove stood. I could feel the words he had taught me on my tongue, whisker from spout, handle to tail. I completed the maneuver again, and this time, as a sweep of my arm came up, I imagined the teapot tipping over and a little brown mouse squeezing out, and whispered, "Spout to a tail." The teapot bulged, then crumpled in on itself. It poured out a great blob of hair and ears, and a moment later, a bright-eyed little mouse with brown fur and bristling whiskers stood on its hind legs and wiggled its nose at us. It pounced from the tabletop and scurried across the floor. The children dove to catch it, but it slipped through a crack in the wall and vanished. "I did it!" I cried, tossing porridge into the air in triumphant glee. Hargrove bellowed with laughter, dancing across the room to snatch paper and pen. "Write it down exactly what you did. I've never seen anything like it." His wide grin fell as he stared at the wall. "That was my only teapot. Well, can't be helped." And then we returned to singing and twirling around the room. The children rejoiced, jumping to clutch my skirts. "I want to do another," I said, breathless. "Excellent. I've just the thing." Hargrove handed me an empty bottle. "Turn that into a teapot." Soon after, Hargrove was pouring us cups of gin-flavored tea. "Little magic mule, that's what I'll call you. A delicate hybrid of both races." "Do you think I'm the only one?" Hargrove grunted. "Don't imagine yourself so special. I know for a fact you're not alone. There have been sorcerer children born as you are, and magician children as well. You're simply in a unique position to realize both halves of your talents."
"How many did you know like me? I mean, back when... well,
back when it was legal to be a public magician?" "One or two. They're dead now, of course. Court training apprentices."
I shuddered to think of it. "Bloody Howard Michaelmas. It's his fault we have to live like this," I said. Hargrove merely shrugged and poured himself some gin. "What was he like?"
"Michaelmas? Why?"
"You're the first person I ever knew who met him." "Was it always clear he was evil?" I asked. Hargrove made a face.
"He was just a proper magical bloke. It's stupid, of course, but if we executed for stupidity, there'd be no one left to walk the planet."
"What did he look like?"
"Don't know. We never saw his face at guild meetings. He'd send a raven or a cat. It would sit in the center of the room, and he'd talk through it. Great party trick. Used to consider him daft, but now no one knows what he looks like. Probably how he survived all these years."
He gulped more tea.
"I don't like talking about him, if it's all the same to you. Irritates me."
I understood his feelings. "Could my father speak through animals?"
"Nope, just the old set yourself on fire routine."
"But he could play with fire. Isn't that a sorcerer trait? Don't you think it odd that a mixture of the abilities can exist in one person?"
He snorted. "Lord, it's as if William Howell rose from the dead and returned to lecture me in a dress. That's a dreadful image."
"My father asked the same questions." I leaned forward.
"Yes,
and arrived at the staggering conclusion of nothing. He sighed. William had such hopes for magic in England. Insane, irrational hopes. He wanted a consortium. He put his thumbs and index fingers together to fashion a triangle. Witches, sorcerers, and magicians. All on the same level. All in service of the crown. All equal. Why? I was eager. Before our lessons, all I had of my father was a half-remembered picture on my aunt's fireplace. Because of his belief that all magic comes down in a straight line. Witches, sorcerers, magicians. Which is a first? I frowned. Enough questions. Hargrove startled me with his brusqueness. I used to tell your father this when he got off on a ridiculous tangent. Knowledge is as powerful as fire. The brighter it burns, the more it devours. Now, we must pay for our lessons, little one. He extended his hand, fingers wiggling. I gave him a sovereign, wincing as I did so. I sold 3 silk hair ribbons. I'll have to tell Lily I lost them, or she'll be out of her mind with worry. Scowling at him, I said, You've made me a thief. I notice you'd no qualms stealing that bread and cheese, he answered, pocketing his money. The church bells struck 6. I leaped to my feet. How had I let time slip by like this? Blast! I'll never get through the ward at this hour. Leave it to me. Hargrove guided me to the curtained-off area that contained his cot and magic trunk. Pulling the bed aside, he revealed 12 odd little squiggly symbols that had been carved into the floorboards, forming a circle about 3 feet wide. Get in. This will take you home. What is it? I stepped inside. A porter's circle. Old magician's trick. It will take you wherever you wish. But you must think clearly of the place, or it might become confused and drop you in northern Africa. What are those lines? I inspected the squiggles around my feet. Something about them looked rather familiar. My dream of the 7 ancients, the night of Korazoth's attack. I'd stood in a circle of stones whose carvings were very similar to these. A chill slid down my spine. I'd learned not to take dreams for granted. These are letters borrowed from summoning circles, reconfigured for our purposes, Hargrove said. Summoning circles. These markings felt wrong. Can't I be like you and disappear on my own? Oh, I'm not that special, Chickling. My cloak, you see, has porter runes sewn into the fabric. He swirled his coat, and I caught the glint of golden thread at the edges by his feet. There was nothing else for it but to use the circle. What do I say? Some magic words? No, say, please take me home. It's only polite. I did as he asked, thinking of the house near Hyde Park. With a loud rushing of wind in my ears, the room vanished. Where on earth did you come from? A startled Agrippa said. I realized with horror that I had appeared beside him on the street. Thankfully, there was no one else nearby. I tried for a nonchalant attitude. I was walking up the other way. Agrippa shook his head. Goodness, I need to be more attentive. Can't have ancients popping up beside me, can I? My heart sank to realize how he trusted me. May we do a lesson in the obsidian room? I asked. Even if I was a magician, I could at least make him proud. Agrippa sighed and looked as if he wanted most to change into his evening clothes and have dinner. I think I've made progress. It's all the reading Lord Blackwood's had me do.
Very well. A little lesson won't hurt us.
Agrippa
fidgeted in his tails and nodded at me, the image of patience. He wanted to eat. I wanted to prove myself.
Pouring a bowl of water before my feet, he said,
"Lift it into the air and fashion it into an orb."
He yawned, understandably expecting little from this. For whatever reason, water was my trickiest element. This time I could feel the power like a second skin. I bent my left knee, and the image formed perfectly in my mind. I concentrated on it, wished for it. I didn't speak, for I didn't have to. The water formed, then lowered itself to puddle on the ground.
Agrippa looked surprised.
That was good.
Then let me try something more difficult. I prepared myself for the fire maneuver. In an instant, I had a swirling vortex of yellow and red flame spinning toward the ceiling. It burned so hot that Agrippa shielded his eyes and dabbed at his forehead with a pocket square. Even in my gown, I found it easy to manage everything. I fell into a sorcerer's crouch with my left leg stretched outward and spun the vortex faster and faster. When I flung both my arms wide, it exploded in a flash of bright light. My powers responded beautifully to my every thought and wish. After so many years living at the mercy of my ability, I'd never imagined that control could feel so wonderful. Agrippa coughed, swiping at flakes of ash that rained down on his coat.
"What on earth have you been doing?" he said.
"Studying, sir." Agrippa began to laugh.
"My girl! My dearest girl!"
He took my hands in his own. We swung about the obsidian room, much in the way I had celebrated with Hargrove that afternoon. He pulled me close and kissed me warmly upon both cheeks. Pride was written all over his face. I was giddy with happiness, almost drunk with it.
"I knew you could do this," Agrippa said.
Joyful tears glinted in his eyes.
"You'll knock the white churches and pale hooks down a peg."
"I'm sorry it took me so long."
"Oh, bother that. We got there in the end, didn't we?"
He lit up with some new thought.
"There are advanced techniques we can try. I've been teaching a couple of the fellows Russian stave movements. I was going to teach them to Gwendolyn before she..."
He stopped, that old sadness settling on him again. "I'm so sorry." Agrippa shook his head, and the gloom vanished.
"Don't be. Now I'm going to train you, Henrietta, my dear girl."
I was Henrietta to him at last. I wanted to drum my hands against the blasted obsidian walls, to scream and shout my triumph. He led us out of the room, calling for everyone. When they appeared on the stairs, they looked at us as though we were mad.
"It's not dinner," Magnus said, his disappointment evident. "What's Hal done now? Set fire to the library by mistake?"
Cellini said, heading downstairs. Well, a rude comment deserved a proper response. The spell to channel a gust of wind was quick upon my stave. I blew Cellini down the last three steps, leaving him sprawled and amazed. Magnus burst out laughing and clapped his hands.
"Brilliant! Show us something more!"
I turned to find Blackwood, blank with surprise. I bowed, as one does before a duel. His eyebrows lifted with understanding. "Are you ready?" I mouthed. He bowed to me in turn, accepting my challenge. In a flash, we each had a stave in hand.
"Use the wind," I said.
With a perfect movement, he cast a gust of air out like a fishing line, high above my head. It curved downward and struck me in the back, almost toppling me.
I'd been purposefully slow to set him at ease. Before he could prepare his second attack, I swirled my stave, moving forward quickly. The wind swept his feet out from under him, and he landed with a grunt on the carpet. He sat up, looking baffled. "Do you yield?" Blackwood dusted his sleeves and extended his long, pale hand for mine. "Help me up, Miss Howell," he smiled faintly. Everyone started talking at once. Dee was offering himself as the next jeweler when Cellini said, "How did you manage it?" He frowned. "You can't have got that much better that fast." "It all suddenly made sense," I said, keeping my tone light. I'd expected someone would bring this up. Really, my biggest surprise was that it wasn't Blackwood pointing it out. Cellini kept at it. "But what happened?" "Stop complaining," Magnus muttered, shoving him. "What are you? English all of a sudden?" Everyone chuckled at that and began talking again. No one was interested in questioning this, to my relief. Feeling playful, I shot a small tongue of fire at Cellini. It exploded in smoke and embers right before his face. He coughed and glared at me. I shrugged. There was no use getting cross with me tonight. I planned on enjoying myself. Magnus held his stave in the air and cried, "To Howl the Sorcerer!" The others joined him, cheering away. Well, all except Blackwood. But he was smiling. As the boys rejoiced, Magnus put his lips to my ear and whispered, "You're one of us now." That night, while the upstairs resounded with laughter and song, I snuck away from the celebration and ran down to the stables to find Rook. Perhaps it was the high of victory, but even the stables appeared transformed in some strange way. The world around me was reborn. He was in the middle of rubbing down a horse when I knocked on the stall door. The animal nosed my hair, attempting a graze. Giggling, I waved my friend out and flung my arms around him. "We're saved," I whispered. All the awkwardness between us melted away. It was as if our last argument had never occurred. "I wish I'd seen it," he said, twirling me about in a circle. "Can you tell me how you managed it?" "One day, when this is all over, I swear I'll give you every detail. It may surprise you." Rook set me down. He looked wonderful. His eyes were bright, and I'd never seen him wear such a carefree smile. "What?" he laughed, noticing my stare. "Forgive me, but you look so happy." "Then I look as I feel," he said, picking me up by the waist. I mock-shrieked as he set me atop a saddle and returned to his work. When a night's sweet like this, how could I do otherwise? "You'll be commended, the greatest sorcerer of the age."
"Second greatest, to hear Magnus talk of himself," I said, rolling my eyes.
"Well, you'll fight him for it. And to top it all off, my pain's gone."
"No,"
I jumped off the saddle.
"Gone completely."
"Haven't felt a twinge in days. Do unmarked people always feel this good? If so, how do they ever find the time to be angry?"
"This is the most wonderful news. It's the medicine Lord Blackwood described, isn't it? He'll never let me forget this great favor of his."
"Have no fear," Rook said with a grin. "You owe him nothing. I've stopped taking the medicine."
"What?" My smile faded. "Then how do you suppress the shadows?"
"Oh, I don't," he said. "See?" He waved behind himself as illustration, and I understood. Upon my arrival, I'd thought that the stable's different appearance was due to my excitement. Now I realized that half the yard lay cloaked in deep shadow. Not even the strong light of the moon could penetrate it. The horses were more silent than usual.
standing watchful in their stools. "Don't worry," Rook said, his voice soothing. "I do it when no one's about. It keeps me in good practice. But I thought the shadows came only when the scars hurt." "So did I. But the most extraordinary thing happened. Just as I was going to ask Mr. Fenswick for the new potion, the pain stopped. For the first time since I can remember, the suffering left. Do you see? I hurt because I couldn't use my power." Rook was no longer living in the prison of his own body. Tears blurred my vision as I wrapped my arms about him. "Why are you crying?" he whispered. "I'm so happy," I sobbed, pressing my cheek to his chest. His heartbeat was loud and steady in my ear. "Now I have everything," he muttered into my hair. The air between us seemed to crackle with energy. It occurred to me that all I had to do was raise my head, and something would happen. I felt that he was waiting for me to grant permission. And though I'd promised myself no complications, I found I was slowly tilting my chin. But the darkness was behind me. It was touching my skirt. It was reaching for me. It was wrong. "I need to go back upstairs," I broke from him so suddenly that he nearly tipped over. Part of me was screaming to stay. Most of me had the uncontrollable urge to run. "The boys and Master Agrippa will wonder where I've gone."
"Of course."
He didn't sound put out in the slightest. "There's time for talk later, after you're commended." Rook smiled at me. His eyes were pure black. "You must get used to it. It's his power. The same way fire is yours," I thought. For the first time, he's free. "I'll come see you later," I said, forcing a smile. Rook turned back to his work, whistling as he did so. Going inside the kitchen, I sat on a bench and passed my hand before my eyes. Honestly, I was acting like a child. Today, I'd been given everything I could have ever asked for. And here I was, worrying. If Rook's pain was finally gone for good, then that was worth everything. Yet I couldn't help but shudder as I returned to stand in the doorway and watch him at work, singing while the shadows ebbed and flowed about his feet. Chapter 18. The midnight bells chimed as Magnus and I skirted the edge of the ward, scanning the dark streets beyond the protective shield. "So you don't believe," Magnus said, "that the ancients are demons from hell?"
"No. Medieval mystics described a fifth element, ether, that they claimed was kept from our eyes only by the thin skin of reality. Many held to those beliefs until they were declared heresy. Perhaps Howard Michaelmas and Mary Willoughby opened a portal into that fifth element."
"Never thought so practical a lady would accept such mystical theories."
I obviously couldn't tell him I discussed said theories with Hargrove. "Then where do you suppose such huge carnivorous beasts came from? Portugal?"
"I suppose your theory is better than the Archbishop's belief that our ancients are the seven deadly sins made flesh," he shuddered. "Is that great blob, Molochoron, the embodiment of lust? Truly, nothing makes me more excited than the sight of mouldy jelly."
I laughed. "I read an article by Blackwood's father, actually, about that seven deadly sins idea. He called those beliefs hogwash. Did you know he was the first to name them ancients in print?"
"Yes,
Blackwood's father was a great sort. Pity the son such a grim sort. Magnus swiped.